Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of In the Barn. I'm Robin.
And I'm Kelsey. In today's episode, we're going to tell the dark and twisted story of probably the most hated racetrack in America, Santa Anita Park in Arcadia, California. In 2019, the general public became painfully aware of the troubles at the track when it was reported that over 20 horses had died in a three-month period while racing at the track. However, these deaths are only a small piece of the long history of this track. Stay with us to learn the history of the Santa Anita racetrack. On the morning of March... Okay. On the morning of March 29th, Santa Anita Park was reopening for racing for the first time in 3 weeks after the mystifying deaths of nearly two dozen horses. Satellite trucks, national news reporters, and animal rights activists converged for what had become a macabre death watch. But California regulators were watching a live surveillance feed of a trainer's assistant carrying a bucket into the stall of a horse named TikTok. Moments after the assistant left, white foam was visible on the horse's lips, often a telltale sign of performance-enhancing drugs. Investigators later found syringes in the bucket, along with fatigue-fighting agent known in racing parlance as a milkshake, according to hearing transcripts from the state's horse racing board. The news that investigators believe TikTok had received such a concoction before the first race, on the first day of the track's return to racing, no less, is indicative of the dysfunction that enveloped Santa Anita the last 6 months, a period when horses had to be euthanized after suffering fractures at an alarming rate. 30 horses have suffered this fate since December 26th at Santa Anita, a storied racetrack that became a flashpoint. So this is the opening to an article from the New York Times that was published in June 26, 2019, that was titled, Why So Many Horses Have Died at Santa Anita. And before you get too worried, TikTok is fine. He has moved to another state. He's now racing in Minnesota.
Oh, good.
As of like June, the beginning of June 2020, he was still racing. It seemed to be fine. Hopefully he's on less drugs. But drugs at racetracks, like this isn't even the first time we've talked about drugs at racetracks in our podcast. We did a whole episode on the Juice Man previously. Like this is such a huge problem at racetracks in the United States that like here's another episode on it, guys.
No, it really is. I mean, racehorses and performance enhancing drugs are practically synonymous. I mean, you can't have one without having the other, which is really unfortunate because that shouldn't be the way that it is.
No, it shouldn't be. It's crazy to think that people are doing this and continuing to essentially get away with it.
I know. And it's sad. It's so heartbreaking. And I couldn't help but think about it the entire time we were doing research for this episode. I kept thinking of ECRA ratings. And I will do an episode on them in the future. But ECRA ratings essentially wants to make eventing where people gamble on it. They wager on eventing. And I just can't help but think what kind of impact that will have on eventing, because anytime you get money involved, the welfare of whoever is performing or competing is out the window. Whether that's sports like basketball or something else, it doesn't matter. Welfare goes out the window so that people can win and make more money.
Yeah, once there's money involved and large amounts of money for everybody, things get strange. Get strange and get dirty quickly.
It gets super dirty real quick. And think about it. The state of California makes so much money off of Santa Anita.
So much money. So much money.
Now, like, of course, they're not going to pass any legislation against it.
Yeah. No, they make an insane amount of money off of racetracks in California. That was like legislation that was passed a long time ago. Like the school boards, a lot of the schools and education is funded by these racetracks. So the state wants them to profit as much as any ownership or, you know, business management wants these tracks to profit.
Exactly.
I think, you know, we'll get into it for sure. But ownership, I'm going to kind of talk about it in my portion of the episode, is how ownership has changed over the decades, because Santa Anita didn't start out where it ended up. Like, it started out with a very different strategy and very different management strategy that was working, but it wasn't, the profits weren't what people want today. I think it's changed a lot how the track is managed over the years.
Right. And they make it so that way, like, part of the funding goes to schools. So you can't take away the funding of the track or do anything that hurts the track, because then you're taking away funding from the schools.
Right, yeah. So when they closing in March was a huge deal because that's lost income for the state as well and for the city. The city also makes a ton of money, and that's how they fund, like, off of the city itself. Like, a lot of their revenues are funded by the track. The state gets money from the track. And so there's the push is to keep racing. We don't want to stop and be closed down for any amount of days because that costs everybody, not just owners of horses, money, but it costs everybody a lot of money to be closed for a day or two.
Yeah, it's insane. My mind was absolutely blown when I found out, because I didn't realize the sheer magnitude of the amount of money that everyone is making off of the track.
Yeah, how many people are involved with this track and just tracks in general? Like, Santa Anita is not special in that respect. Like, they're not necessarily unique. There's a lot of tracks in California that are part of this due to, like, the age of Santa Anita, because it's a pretty old track. They were built in the 30s. I think that also plays a huge factor, that for so many decades, everybody has been basing their budget off of this track. So, like, that's really important to keep in mind when you're thinking of public funds, is that we need, as, like, governments need to know that they have a stable amount of income so they can plan projects and improvements and stuff annually and in these chunks that they do, because a lot of times governments plan 5, 10 years, you know, 20 year cycles, and you need to know you're having that money come in. So to risk losing that money is a huge deal. So for this story, we're going to tell it in true In the Barn fashion. We're going to go back to the very beginning. My notes originally had me going, like, all the way back to when indigenous people roamed across this land, because it's actually, this piece of land has a really, like, it's just a very complicated story. There was never, like, a good moment on this land. It's really interesting. I don't know that we have time to go all the way that far back.
Probably not. Got to shorten it up just a smidge.
Also, do you want to tell the people why we've been gone for so long? can I, like, point the finger at you?
Yeah, I take full responsibility for the fact that we have not been able to record or upload an episode in forever, because recently I unfortunately had to move from my lovely home in North Carolina and relocate to Alabama. And if I'm being honest, the move has been a complete nightmare.
Yeah. So she's been busy trying to make her house livable.
It has been so bad. It has been such a freaking nightmare. It has been the move from hell. We moved into the house only to discover that not only did the previous sellers, or, like, the owners of the house, let their animals go to town whizzing on the carpets, they then turned off the AC, and so that stench and awfulness was just cooking in the house for, like, a couple of weeks before we finally opened the doors and got a whiff of that in our faces and, like, immediate headaches the day we arrived. And then we discovered that the carpets were infested with fleas. The barn has a whole freaking bat colony in it. There was, like, a massive leak that happened the first day we were here, flooding the laundry room. Like, it has been so awful.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm not you.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I am me. But yeah, I am the reason why we have not been able to record or upload an episode in forever, because I had to go pretend to be an adult for a little bit and handle adult responsibilities, which sucked. It was awful. I tried handing in my 2 weeks resignation, my 2 weeks notice. No one would accept it.
Yeah, you're still required to be an adult by law.
Apparently so.
I'm glad I'm not you, and I'm glad I'm not living in Southern Alabama. Though, I also would be open to trying it, but then you did send me a video of a cockroach, so I'm probably okay. Are we ready to talk, Santa Anita?
I think we are. We've given our reasoning for why we've been a little MIA over the last couple of weeks, and now it is time to get into the reason why we are all here, and that is the bloody, sordid history of Santa Anita Track. Also, quick side note, when I first began my research, I thought it was Santa Anita, like S-A-N-A Anita. It's not. It's Santa Anita.
Same. I thought it was like San Francisco, but it's not. It's Santa Anita. So I'm going to mispronounce this 100 times, because I'm just going to say Santa Anita, because I always thought it was Santa Anita. And trying to say Santa Anita is really challenging. So for my portion of the episode, we're going to roll the clocks back. We're going to go back to the beginning of the track, and I'm going to walk you through the decades up to the 2000s. So it's going to be some history. It's going to be interesting. I've got a lot of information, a lot of facts to throw at you. And then Robin, her part will be kind of what happened in 2019 and a lot of that drama.
Yes, that is what I'll be talking about.
To start us off, where in the world are we? So Arcadia, California, which is the town that Santa Anita Track is located in, the track is literally in the heart of Arcadia, like the center of this town. Arcadia is about 13 miles northeast of LA, and it is right at the base of the San Gabriel Mountains. And this is where the San Gabriel Mission originally was. And the San Gabriel Mission was one of the most productive missions in California when California was part of Mexico. It's a great location because it's just outside of LA. So you get a lot of celebrity presence at Santa Anita. And this has been like a big part of Santa Anita throughout the years, especially in the beginning when celebrities loved horse racing in like their 30s and 40s. And so being as close to LA as it was, it allowed a lot of celebrities to come out and make appearances and watch the horses run and gamble. In fact, I didn't know this, but Alex Trebek, he used to own racehorses and he had like two large racehorse thoroughbred farms in California.
Like Alex Trebek, Jeopardy Alex Trebek?
Yeah, that Alex Trebek. Yeah, so he had horses that ran at Santa Anita, so he was often a presence there, which I didn't know. I thought that was interesting. But it's really strange when you look at a map of the area, like if you look at a Google image, the track, like I said, is in the heart of the town. It is literally surrounded by shopping malls. Like there's a Macy's, a Dave and Buster's, stone's throw from the track, and then you have all of the shopping mall on one side, and there's a reason for this, which I will tell you eventually. And then you're surrounded by like single family residences and lots of apartment buildings. But it just seems like a weird place to have 61 horse barns. The barns are literally right on top of each other. It's surrounded by asphalt. Like it is very much in a suburban environment, which I guess for me, the only experience I have with racetracks is they're a little bit more rural. They're like out in the farmland. So this is just, it's not unique to California. There are a lot of these older tracks, like Del Mar is similar, that are down in a downtown. I just like I can smell it. You know what I'm saying? Like I can smell the racetrack from here, especially Southern California.
It makes me think of SeaWorld. Literally. Yeah. I was looking at pictures of it too, and it just makes me think of SeaWorld.
Yeah, it's just a strange location, but it makes sense when you start to understand the history of that area, and California just has a huge population. I also loved like looking at old newspapers. So most of my resources for this episode, I spent a lot of time on newspapers.com looking at newspapers. That's like where all my information comes from, is newspaper articles from that time period. So I'm not going to be able to share every single source as I go through, but I will share some of them.
Okay.
So like I said, I'm not going to go all the way back to the beginning of this land and tell the tumultuous story of it. But before 1875, this piece of land had spent 40 years in court. The owner of this piece of property spent 40 years in court suing and going back and forth with the U.S. government because the U.S. government like never wanted to acknowledge that he owned this property. And he spent 40 years and ended up dying like penniless, renting out his homestead, like living in his homestead that someone else had purchased and allowed him to live in. So this property, like it's an insane story about how because Mexico had given him the property prior to the U.S. coming in and claiming California and winning California, essentially. The U.S. was like, this land is beautiful. We want it. No one else can have it. And so there was two people in all of California, Alta California, that the United States government decided not to honor their deeds. And so this person spent 40 years, I think his name is Henry Dalton, spent 40 years in court trying to like get his land.
But did they honor other deeds, or were there only two people in California at the time? They're like, none of your deeds are good.
Nope. They honored everybody else's deeds because,
oh, those shifty bastards.
If you've been to Southern California and you look around, you'll understand why. Like there wasn't a lot. So the United States government didn't care who owns the rock and the dust and the dirt. But this portion, because San Gabriel Mission had owned 1.5 million acres of some of the most productive lands, like they had made it very productive. They were growing tons of grapes and it was wineries. There was lots of agriculture, orchards, all kinds of stuff the mission had put in. But so it's a crazy story watching that go back and forth and all the stuff that happened there. However, in 1875, ownership of this land became really clear who owned it. And a gentleman by the name of Elias Jackson Baldwin, aka Lucky Baldwin, purchased, I believe it was like 8,000 acres that would someday become Arcadia and would the Santa Anita racetrack, as well as I think he ended up accumulating 46,000 1,000 acres in this area, and he is responsible for Arcadia, Pasadena, Baldwin Park, and a portion of Sierra Madre. Those are all towns that his land now has been turned into. Lucky Baldwin was a very rich man. He was very successful in business. He had a great ability to make money in the stock market. He owned hotels, mines, banks, large shares in railroad, ice and gas stocks, wineries, orchards, and lots of racehorses. He referred to them as blooded horses. That's like their term for racehorses in that time period, as well as like horses of good lineage were called blooded horses. He was both into harness horses and good old American thoroughbred flesh. And Lucky Baldwin is basically responsible for bringing thoroughbreds to California and bringing horse racing to California. He was once asked in court how much he thought his horses were worth, and he responded to the lawyer that was cross-examining him, "Neither you nor anybody else can put a value on them." So he had no idea how many horses he owned, and he was just kind of being a jerk in the trial this day, because this comes from a really famous case of his, which he was being sued for. A woman was suing him for a broken heart and a breach of contract, because he Lucky Baldwin is literally one of the most bizarre men I've ever heard of, and I actually was so intrigued by how crazy this person was, I bought a book on him and everything, because this man is bizarre.
Oh my gosh.
But anyways, he came to California, he purchased this land, he started a railroad that ran through where Arcadia would then be one day. He bought Santa Anita Rancho, which is where Santa Anita Racetrack is, for $23 an acre in 1875, which actually is, I think, a lot of money, though they were saying that he got a really good deal on it. But 23 acres, I didn't put that into an inflation converter. But I know in the 60s, people were buying land for $32 an acre. So it kind of seems like a lot, but maybe I don't know land prices at all. When he had that ranch, he had 500 working mule, 500 draft horses and carriage horses, and 250 thoroughbreds on his ranch in California.
Wow, that's a lot.
However, at this time, as we go into from 1870s into 1880s, 90s, and then eventually into the 1900s, racing was really not a big thing in California. This was becoming more and more illegal. Politicians thought that this was a really unsavory activity. It was morally corrupt. To gamble was morally corrupt, and it was similar to robbery, and that soon, if you gamble, there's also drinking, because this was the time when prohibition was about to become a thing in the 1920s. So it was a time of the progressive era where they were trying to regulate morals and public morals and values through legislation. So horse racing was becoming illegal in California. More and more city councils were banning it and banning basically pari-mutuel betting, which is the form of betting that's used in horse racing. So it's basically everyone puts their money into a pool for that horse, and then that pool gets divided back out by some sort of structure. That pool has rules how that money gets divided back out. And that is how gambling on sports activities works. And it's the same format we use today. So that was becoming illegal. It never became illegal in Arcadia, because Arcadia was founded in 1903. A Lucky Baldwin was the mayor, and he loved horses. And so he was never going to make it illegal in Arcadia. He was actually quoted as being a bit of a dictator and getting whatever he wanted in this town, because he owned the town, essentially. I found a quote from him where he moves to California and becomes a mayor and starts his own town, because that's how you have freedom in America. That is the American dream, is to be your own politician and make up your own rules. That's true freedom.
Oh my gosh. That's insane that he was he bought his town, was the mayor of his town, and made laws for his town. He was his town.
Yeah, no, he was the town. So I found an article that is from the Los Angeles Times, and it was written in November 1907, which called him a dictator of the town of Arcadia. The title of the article is "Lucky Baldwin, the Proud Monarch of the Queerest Little Kingdoms." Everyone knows how a feebly conceived state law has made it possible for Baldwin to become absolute dictator of the city of Arcadia. Also made it possible for the old monarch to license racetrack gambling within his dominions, whether all the rest of the community is opposed to it or not. So this newspaper was interviewing him for his birthday, though his birthday's not in November, it's in April, so I'm not even going to question that.
They were close enough.
Close enough. But here is a quote from Lucky. "I've had to fight with guns and lawsuits and politics to keep this ranch. And now I am going to have what I want on it. And that's racing." Old Lucky took off his dark glasses, which he has worn since being threatened with blindness a year or so ago. Young man, he said, I'm the oldest horse owner there is, and I started horse racing in California. I brought the first racing stable across the continent, and I liked horse racing well enough to pay $1,800 a car to get them here.
That was a lot.
That was a lot. $1,800 a car to get your horses out here. So Lucky Baldwin ended up building a racetrack on his portion of Arcadia, and I think it is where the golf course is now. So there's a golf course directly adjacent to the Santa Anita racetrack, and that's where his original racetrack was built in 1907. So the first race was held on Thanksgiving Day, 1907. Well, it was supposed to be held on Thanksgiving Day, but it didn't get held until December 7th because it took them extra long to get the barn ready and get the facility ready. It was designed at that time to accommodate 250 horses. However, almost 1,000 horses showed up for the first racing season because Lucky Baldwin promised them this like gem, this beautiful, perfect, best racing track in the world. And so 1,000 horses showed up for the first racing season, and they had to like keep them in the infield because there was no barns for 1,000 racehorses. So even the Keene brothers of Keeneland in Kentucky, they brought 11 horses out here. And so one of the early sort of formats for these races was to offer huge prize money. And that huge prize money would allow for the best horses, the best trainers, and the best jockeys to make it affordable to come out to these locations. About 7,000 people turned out for the first race, but Arcadia had a population of 1,000 people.
Holy crap, Well, they didn't quadruple it. They did whatever seven is.
But it was also because it was illegal everywhere else, right?
Right.
This is one of the few towns where horse racing was still allowed. However, 2 years later in 1909, California officially banned horse racing and he had to close his track down. So they got to finish their 1909 season, but the Senate Committee on Public Morals decided to pass a law that basically banned pari-mutuel gambling throughout the state of California, and that made horse racing infeasible if you couldn't gamble on it. I mean, you could just watch horses run around, but that wasn't really why people were there.
Which, you know what? That's actually a really good point, is even in the beginning of horse racing, people weren't there to watch the horses run around.
Nope, there was always, right, a side pot.
Yeah, it was always about the gambling and the money.
So a month after horse racing became illegal in California, Lucky Baldwin died, and his track sort of closed down and fell into disrepair. Interestingly enough, 3 years later, the track burned down. So January 31st, the track is burning down. The grandstands, the paddocks catch on fire. And I think it's really interesting that February 1st marked the day that horse racing became illegal. And January 31st, the night of January 31st into the morning of February 1st, 3 years later, the track burns down. The track was only a couple years old. I know a lot of reports say it fell into disrepair, but it was the most beautiful, like perfect, so much money. He had spent millions of dollars in 1909 to build this track. So you're telling me that's the amount of time it took for this track to fall in disrepair to the point it catches on fire due to an electrical issue?
Yeah, that's either some poetic justice or some arson.
So I have a tiny tinsy theory. So just a few days before that track burned down, a few weeks before that track burned down, right? Lucky Baldwin had died. And the track business still existed because it was like an ownership group, and there was still a business. Even though they weren't running a track, there was still that entity hoping that racing would become legal again. That business changed hands, and his business manager while he was alive was now the owner of this business. And so it's not like there's a difference between being the estate manager and having rights over it and actually becoming the owner of that business. So the man who had been his business manager for most of his life now suddenly owned this track. All the paperwork was in order, including the insurance, which is surprising because Lucky Baldwin is known for not carrying enough insurance. He had one of the most famous hotels in United States was the San Francisco Hotel, and it burned down and he had no insurance to rebuild. It was crazy. He did not carry insurance. But the paperwork for the track, it was in order. The insurance was ordered. It burned down and the gentleman collected almost $75,000.
Interesting. Interesting. I don't want to suggest foul play, but something smells amiss.
I don't want to either. And it's also interesting is that in Arcadia, it was reported that fires were common in this town, and that was due to a large immigrant population that would come in to work the orchards and the fields. And they lived in like you know, shanty type housing. They lived in really poor housing. And it was reported that these caught on fire frequently. Yet the racetrack burning down was one of two fires that I found reported that year. But they said Arcadia burns all the time. The other fire was an employee of Baldwin's, or one of his, like, now his ranch's employees. I don't know. I'm not saying anything weird happened. I'm just saying something weird happened. Anyways, now that Lucky Baldwin is gone, Arcadia, right, he died. Arcadia and California could finally pass legislation that prohibited pari-mutuel betting. And it would be about 20 years before the idea of another racetrack came back up for discussion in that area. And 21 years before California would allow for gambling again. So I found an article titled Racetrack to be Built on Anita Baldwin Estate. So Anita Baldwin was Lucky's daughter from, I think, his second or third marriage. So horse racing is not the only coming, is not only coming back to Southern California, but will return to the very site where it once flourished. It was all settled yesterday that another horse racing plant will be erected, this one to be located on the Anita Baldwin Estate near Arcadia. Joseph M. Smoot, pioneer racing man of Florida, who has been here for weeks surveying the situation, picked the site yesterday. He had first learned lean towards the site at Crenshaw Boulevard and Jefferson Avenue, but the glamour surrounding the old Santa Anita Rancho led him to believe that this was the ideal spot. Anita Baldwin will be a director of the new organization. Construction work on a portion of her estate will begin as the Santa Anita Park will be started in a few days. Smoot's organization will be known as the Los Angeles Jockey Club. He will be president of this controlling group. All the directors are said to have been chosen. A $50,000 California Derby to attract the best horse flesh in the country has been mapped out by the organizer. Smoot's announcement last night came on the heels of a similar declaration by Alexander Patinage, who will build a plant at Redondo and Imperial Boulevards. A third course is in prospect with Harry L. Lewis and Associate proposing to erect a plant in Baldwin Park.
What a last name, though.
Smoot?
Smoot.
Also, I don't think Smoot's on the up and up, and I could have told you that just based off his last name. You know what I mean? Like,
well, it's a Smoot point now.
Right. It's...
You gave me the opportunity. I had to take
it. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to set you up like that. That was my bad. So in the early 1930s, things were bleak across the country as 4 years earlier, the Depression had hit. So the Great Depression, people don't have a lot of money, and rich people who still have a lot of money are looking at bringing back exciting things to their cities. And one of those was proposing a plant, a racetrack plant. And yes, plant is the term that is used all the time in the 30s and 40s, which I think is so
telling.
There's something so ironic. Plants, like a factory, like a product you're producing. Like, I think like of a meatpacking plant is honestly what I think of when you use the term racetrack plant. You're producing a product, and how much value do you place on that product?
Right. It's not something conducive to, I don't know, an animal that's alive.
I mean, it's just, yeah, it's just a weird term, but that's what they used.
It's disturbing terminology.
I agree. Yeah, it's a disturbing name. So Anita Baldwin now owns her father's ranch, a part of his estate, and she was very much cut from the same fabric her father was. She was a bit eccentric, but she also had a huge love for the ponies and really wanted to bring racing back to her community. However, in the early 1930s, 1932, when they were proposing to get this racetrack built, there was a lot of opposition from the community. Still, mostly church leaders, Boy Scout leaders, school leaders, all were very opposed because how do you say that if you're in the Great Depression, how do you convince people that gambling is what your community needs, right? Like, it is a hard sell, I think, when you're in the midst of like one of the biggest economic downturns the country has ever seen.
Yeah, a little bit.
There was a group called Friends of Permanent Progress, and they were only around for a short period of time in order to fight the track. And they ran an ad in the local newspapers that was anti the track. What they wanted to do was they wanted to stop voters from voting to approve the track. So it's a little bit, you kind of have to understand how cities operate. Essentially, what was happening was they wanted to rezone Anita Baldwin's property in order to allow this commercial track to be put on her property. They say rezone in all the articles, but what they really mean was a zoning change. It means nothing to you as an audience, but to me, that's a big deal and a big difference is they're doing an ordinance change that is basically basically the zone, I think, is going to stay the same, but it's now just going to allow for a racetrack to go in that zone. It's a little bit different process is all.
And we got the city planner here trying to explain to us the nuances.
Oh, it was really exciting. I was like, they're rezoning? The what? What? And the planning commission is doing what? I got really excited because I was like, I know the stuff. But essentially what happens is you have to get the planning commission, who works underneath the city council, has to give the stamp of approval, and then the city council has to give the stamp of approval. Now, I don't know if this is unique to California or unique to the time, but the city council didn't want to make the vote. They didn't want to be responsible, and so they decided to pass the vote to the people, and they decided to have a special election where all the residents in Arcadia would vote if they wanted to allow for a racetrack. The Friends for Permanent Progress ran an ad that lists 8 reasons why we shouldn't allow the racetrack, just like all about, you know, what is more criminal than to raise false hopes in the hearts of needy people.
Sure, sure.
But my favorite is number 8. How safe would Arcadia girlhood be in the light of the following statement made this week by a reputable person? Not even going to mention who that reputable person is, but trust me, they're reputable. Who speaks out of actual experience with the racetrack of today. I would not think of leaving my daughter at home alone even for an hour during the racing season. Is that why some advocates of the track say leave morals out of the question? So essentially, if there's a racetrack in your community, it is too dangerous to leave women and or girls home alone. We are quite feeble and quite susceptible to racetracks. I don't know what, like,
you know what though, it might actually be a fair point. Most girls like ponies,
right? And that's what I'm like thinking, like, girls, there's some funny things about how women were viewed at this period of time, about like people did not, I didn't realize how much men really thought women were the weaker of all. Like, we couldn't even go to the barn. It was like too dangerous for women to even go into the barn.
Oh my God.
We love horses. What are you talking about? It's too dangerous for men to go into the barn. But essentially what happened in order to get this to pass the vote. So Smoot was basically a racetrack promoter and creator. So he traveled around the country developing racetracks, and he promised that this would be like no other racetrack in the United States. It would compete with this thing called the Kentucky Derby. Santa Anita would be bigger and better than the Kentucky Derby and any races that Churchill Downs ever had.
Okay, well, that's a bold statement.
That was his promise. He also promised a lot of jobs, and I think jobs is what eventually sold people, because in July 26, 1932, the vote passed. This was a special election. Everyone was happy. Like, apparently there was like screaming and partying in the street when they found out the vote passed. Like, the newspaper articles explain, like, people ran into the street screaming and banging on pots and pans with excitement that they were getting a racetrack.
Well, I guess they didn't have Instagram and stuff back then, so it was probably their only option.
Right, like, there wasn't a lot of entertainment at that time, so I guess that makes sense. So basically 2 weeks later, shovels were in the dirt. It was sentimental, dirt shoveling, because they actually still did need permits and needed to design the facility. But I was actually shocked when I found out they had to get building permits in the 1930s for this. I was like, wow, California, way to go. But they kind of set an unrealistic goal and thought that they started construction in August and that they would be open and ready to go February 1933. And they were not. They were not ready to go at that time.
Well, yeah, I could have told them that.
However, pari-mutuel betting, that restriction in California was lifted in 1933. So they did still need that in 1932. I love that they approved the racetrack, even though gambling was still technically illegal in Florida or in California. But my understanding is that they had a lot of inside information. There are a lot of people that are involved in the track initially. So initially, it was owned by Anita Baldwin, and she ended up selling the track like a year or two later to the Los Angeles Jockey Club. There is some discussion about Smoot just disappearing halfway through construction, but there's also the counter of that story being he got kicked out, that there was tensions between him and Anita, or him and other members, board members, and he ended up just leaving this project. He was really upset that he had to leave it, but he never got to see it finished. At a period of time, the racetrack switch changed hands before it even opened a couple of times. Comstock ended up, he was a hotelier, and he ended up purchasing the track from Anita Baldwin. Smoot was out. It was no longer the Jockey Club. It became the Turf Club.
Ooh, the Turf versus the Jockeys. The new gangs on the block.
Part of the reason Arcadia got opened and the Jockey Club was originally involved was because another park in California was closing. And so they brought all the stuff from that closing California park over, like all the chairs, all the booths, a lot of that stuff. And it's controversial because it was the Jockey Club ended up getting kicked out once they brought everything over. and then the turf club took over.
Oh.
So on Christmas Day 1934, the first race occurred at Santa Anita. One of the cool things Santa Anita did, was the first track to ever do, was have a photo finish camera. It cost about $100,000 in 1934, but apparently cameras are way better at figuring out who won and crossed the line first than the human eye. The human eye is too feeble, is what the news reports said. The article's called Human Eyes Too Feeble, which I don't disagree with.
Yeah, I'll concede this point.
So the parking lot could hold up to 60,000 cars, and the stables could hold up to 1,000 horses. There were 6 bars, multiple cafes, sandwich shops, and this building was very famous. The architect that designed Santa Anita Racetrack also went on to do another project a year later, referred to as the Grand Hoover Dam.
Oh!
And I'm confused as to what is the connection there. Because the architect...
Yeah, how do you...
Yeah, how do you do... Like, one of those feels like an engineer should be involved.
Yeah, so a racetrack and a dam feel like two very different things that often don't have two things in common.
Yeah, and he was a building architect. Like, he had done a lot of LA's, the city of LA's downtown buildings, like City Hall and the library, and I think a few other municipal buildings, and the Hoover Dam. On opening day, 39,000 people showed up to watch the 8 races that were scheduled, including Clark Gable. He was there. He was a very famous actor of that time period, and he showed up. However, the whole thing almost didn't happen because before the first race, the track got shut down due to a groom strike. All 700 grooms decided to go on strike, and they refused to bring the horses out of the barn to the paddock in order to get ready for the upcoming race because it had to do with something called the louse ring. So the grooms were not allowed to go into the stands to watch the races if they're like, even if the horse was racing or they were done for the day or they had a break, they were like banned from going into the grandstands, and they could watch the races from the louse ring, which was like a roped off section at the end of the track. And they refused to bring the horse until they were given permission to enter the grandstands.
Wow.
So unions obviously were really big at this time, and there are a lot of different unions, like the Grooms Union, and which also includes like stable boys, and then they have a union for the people that worked at the betting booths and worked internally. So there was a lot of different unions and a lot of different strikes that plagued this park over the years. 5 days after the first race, the track had to do its first drug investigation. 5 days after, a horse by the name Adobe Post made some suspicious runs. He like had one run, he was really fast. Then the second run, he was dead last. And then he was really fast in first. So I think he went first, last, first in 3 races. And that was really, really suspicious. So this was January 1935. The Sacramento Bee recaps that owner Herbert H. Brown and jockey Paul Clearand were exonerated of any culpability at the off-form running of the horse Adobe Post by the stewards of Santa Anita Track after a 3-day inquiry. The steward's statement said, apprentice jockey Paul Cleland plea that he was carried out on the first turn and took the horse back to save ground is in keeping with the facts that were accepted by the stewards. Adobe Post is a patched-up cripple with greatly enlarged ankles, and it is possible that he struck one of them in the crowding at the first turn. And so that's why he did so bad, because he's a cripple horse.
Well, okay, then how do you justify how well he did?
I don't know, but that's like, that was the investigation determined he was just a crippled horse. Okay, so the following month, February 1935, a poor gentleman was killed while trying to cross the racetrack. The horses had passed, they'd run their race, he thought the track was clear, and he went to cross it, and the last horse ran over him.
Oh my God.
And I just don't know who that is more insulting to, like, the man for not, like, that's how far behind this other horse was that people were walking out onto the track, and this poor horse was still running. Like, he was like, don't forget about me. I'm still here.
Oh, my God. That's so awful. That poor guy that died, that poor horse that hit him.
Yeah, the horse is behind by, like, 100 yards. He, like, didn't even notice. And like, oh my God, you got killed. Like, that is also, that is horrible, but like,
that is so bad.
That's so bad. That like, the horse was so slow that like,
Oh my god. It must have been like a Prius, right? If they're under 5 miles per hour, they're completely silent.
The horse is running so like, low. I guess. I don't know. So there was also in the very beginning of the racetrack a lot of issues around how betting was happening. There was a lot of illegal gambling going on. In order to gamble on the horses, you had to be present at the track. You could do wire betting, but it was very complicated how wire betting worked. And so there was a lot of police raids. A lot of bookies were constantly being arrested for trying to like scoop the system. Like this included even like hiding in the bushes. Apparently people would build little tree houses in the trees around the track in order to like watch the going ons and have different views of the race. And a lot of people were trying to change the odds and the bets as the horses were racing. So from day one, they had issues with how gambling was being handled at the racetrack, and it was constantly something that the police were trying to keep an eye on and trying to regulate. But at the same time, they're making a lot of money that the California Racing Board and government isn't going to be super motivated to try to regulate this. So it was this kind of constant back and forth between how the police wanted to handle the laws and how the governing agents wanted to respond. By 1940, the track was making $10 million a year.
Holy crap, in 1940?
In 1940. And I did not do the conversion on any of this money, but that's a lot more than $10 million today. Yeah, they're making $10 million a year. And they even, through a lot of promotion and a lot of negotiation, got a horse by the name of Seabiscuit to come out and run on the track in the early 40s.
Yes, they're very proud of Seabiscuit's ties to Santa Anita.
I think he ran like twice. He won something, congratulations, but I don't think he spent a lot of time at Santa Anita.
Yeah, but they're really proud about that.
They are really proud about that. Well, small tragedies happened here and there at Santa Anita as we go into the 40s. There was a much bigger tragedy that happened in the 40s at Santa Anita that we have to talk about just for a second. And that was World War II was happening at this time. So in 1939, World War II started in the United States and this war went on for 6 years. On December 7th, the White House announced that the Japanese had attacked an American naval base known as Pearl Harbor. At that time, the U.S. government did not know how to respond. So this affected Santa Anita. Essentially, racing was banned that very day because the government and the army was in control. Like, the army had a lot of control in the 40s, and so they immediately banned racing because it was large gatherings of people, but you have 40,000 people gathering at these tracks, and the army was worried that, especially for these coastal states, that that would be a potential target for the Japanese or the Germans or whomever. They ended up closing these tracks, and they kept them closed for quite a few years. So by March 20th, 1942, the racetrack was taken over by the U.S. government and by the army. And this was in order to provide temporary housing for Japanese evacuees from the coastal zone. Ugh. So essentially what happened is the government decided that there was going to be an exclusion zone along the coastline. And that zone changed every couple days. It got bigger and bigger, and they would give residents of Japanese descent, so they were Japanese and their American-born children were asked to leave. They were asked to leave by soldiers with guns and were escorted. If you didn't have a car to drive,
it wasn't really a question. It was more of a armed suggestion.
Correct. The first several evacuations that occurred were done with tanks and guns, and people were marched.
Oh my God.
Later evacuations, as the areas got bigger and bigger and they started evacuating places like Beverly Hills, they did allow people to drive their own cars to these evacuation centers. And again, these were evacuation centers because the idea was that these residents, these citizens, could not live close to the coast because they, I mean, you like, I don't understand, right? Like, what did you, they thought they were gonna communicate with, and they could be radicalized and they could attack, right? They could get information somehow because they lived on the coast and that made them dangerous. Like that, they got 7 days to basically sell everything and carry what they could to these temporary settlements. And then from there, they would be bused to other states like Wyoming, Colorado, Arkansas, where internment camps were set up for them.
Gosh, that breaks my heart for those families. That's so needlessly cruel, and just I can't even imagine the horror and the heartbreak each one of them was going through to like just be turned on like that.
It's insane and humiliating and horrible. And I read some articles. There was one article that interviewed a couple, and the article was like, they're excited for a vacation. They can't wait. It's like,
oh my God.
Hold up. Not a vacation. They had to sell all their belongings. Let's hold up, get rid of their business. Hold up, not a vacation.
Oh my God, you're going to make me cry. That is awful.
I'm not going to stop. There's a little bit more of this because I think it is important to acknowledge. In 2012, some 71 years later, one of those American-born children recalled his experience for the Board of Supervisors in LA County in an effort to get the board to sort of take back essentially what had happened in the 40s and make public statements for, you know, human rights, that what happened was wrong. So that gentleman recounted the days when soldiers with shining bayonets on their rifles banged on the door of his Los Angeles home and herded his family into a waiting truck. They were taken with others of Japanese lineage to living quarters in a horse stable at the Santa Anita racetrack that reeked of manure. As my mother carried my baby sister in a duffel bag, I saw tears rolling down her cheeks, he said. She thought it was the most humiliating and degrading experience of her life. His family was later relocated to an internment camp in Arkansas, where Takei would go to school in tar paper barracks, line up 3 times a day to eat in a noisy mess hall, and bathe in a group shower. George Takei is not shy about sharing his and his family's experience of being forced from their homes and essentially being imprisoned for over a year. So George Takei was one of the families that lived in the Santa Anita horse stalls that days earlier had held horses. I don't know if you've seen a horse stall after a horse has been in it. It's not clean. And they converted those all to 2-bedroom apartments where they stayed until October. Oh my God. March through October. And then in October, they were transported to Arkansas, where they then lived for like another year or so. And every like week or so, it went from like 1,000 people showed up the first week, then 2,000, 3,000, 4,000. By April 7th, 1942, 6,000 Japanese Americans were removed from their homes and evacuated and now living in horse stalls. They did eventually in the parking lots because they got up to 18,000 Japanese Americans that were living at Santa Anita. The parking lot was at one point converted over to barracks.
God, that's so awful. This track has such an awful history.
It's just crazy, I guess, all the stuff that happened. So I found an article that was written sort of at the end of when they had evacuated and the Santa Anita was now empty. So Cold Vital Statistics will record that the reception center was the place of 161 babies were born, where 20 deaths occurred, where 23 couples met, fell in love, and were married, where one couple couldn't take it and got a divorce. History will record those as mere figures of a 6-month episode. But old copies of The Pacemaker will paint it as one of the most unique sidelights of the world at war. 6 months ago, Japanese were moved into Santa Anita from every corner of the Pacific coast. They came from Seattle, San Francisco, the Inland Cities, Terminal Island, Little Tokyo, and Beverly Hills. And they ended up 18,000 residents were there before they were relocated. But I do think it's just, they have a very glossy way of recounting the times there, talking about how nice the stalls were. They moved into dirty horse stalls, but by the time they moved out, they were lovely 2-bedroom apartments. Like, no, they weren't.
But they fell in love. Only one couple got divorced.
Right? Great. The track also did contribute in other ways to the war efforts. There was a rubber drive. And so in 1942, they donated all the rubber mats from the, like, they weren't stall mats. They were the mats that, like, people, the staff stood on, like your kitchen mats and things like that, to be more comfortable in the bedding area. So they donated all their rubber mats. And then once it was emptied at the end of 1942, the army did move into Santa Anita for training grounds. But by the end of 1944, things started to look normal again for the track. The race ban was lifted and horses were ready to return by December 30th, 1944. However, just days before, they were supposed to, like the night before actually, they were supposed to start racing. Horse racing was banned across the country. So like the ban had been lifted for California. They ship 1,000 horses into Santa Anita and then the army bans horse racing for the same reason, gathering across the nation. And so wouldn't it be until 1945 again before the racetrack would open. And essentially what the government said was that V-Day, you could
the ban on racing would be lifted V-Day. So the day America claims victory, the war's, you know, officially over, V-Day, you can start racing again. And so May 15th, 1945, they had their first race since 1941. By the start of the 1950s, things did start to slow down a little bit. The starting gate in the 1950s was held in place by draft horses. So draft horses would pull the starting gate, like, out onto the track and then have to stand there and hold it while the thoroughbreds, like, loaded and then started from it.
So what happens then if, like, the draft horse isn't used to us? And just bolts with all the horses loaded into the starting gates.
You really hope that doesn't happen. There was also, so because they ran in January a lot, there was also a lot of weather problems that were happening. And I found a story in 1952 about a poor gentleman who was using wind machines that they had brought in from Hollywood to dry the infield and dry portions of the track. And he walked into the blade of one of the fans and, like, gutted himself.
Ow. Oh my God.
As far as I know, he lived, but this is why fans now are enclosed, because people used to just walk into them and, like, cut themselves. So that same month, a night watchman was arrested for, and this is January 1952, a night watchman who guards the barns was arrested for starting fires. Like, he just had a fire fetish and would start lighting the barn on fire.
Well, I mean, how are you going to protect the barn from yourself?
And a week later, one of the bookies at the betting window was robbed of $3,000.
Oh my God. So it was like one thing after another.
Oh, one thing after another, because this isn't even the end of January. And at the end of January, on January 29th, 1952, Gwen Vanderbilt, of that family lineage, the Vanderbilts, trash-talked Santa Anita at a public lunch that the racetrack was, like, paying for. So the racetrack decided to cover this board's lunch, this free lunch, and Vanderbilt has the audacity to call out Santa Anita as a horrible track. So he blasted the track, and this was, like, a huge, like, in the 50s, this was still a social seat. And I think he had investments in another track, and he was just upset that his horses weren't doing well at Santa Anita. So by now, everybody knows Vanderbilt verbally sucked Santa Anita's racetrack conditions and its officiating. One would have thought he was talking about Galt. For anybody to have the audacity to condemn publicly anything about Santa Anita almost borders on sacrilegious. It required the great track about 2 days to recover from the jolt. Then Carlton E. Burke, director of racing and about second in command for Doc Strub, so Dr. Strub, Charles Strub was the president and owner of the track at this time, replied, he said, in effect, Vanderbilt was a crybaby about his stable and wanted things his own way. Burke was empathetic that if Vanderbilt did not like the way Santa Anita was run, he could pick up his horses and go home. Burke is vice president of the association over which Vanderbilt presides. The little guys who are lucky to get a stall at the pompous place secretly were elated over Vanderbilt's criticism. Many think the same, but know if they want stalls next year, they had better keep quiet. So they didn't go into any detail about, like, what was actually happening, why Vanderbilt would be making statements like this, throwing Santa Anita under the track. But it was very, there was a lot of stuff going on sort of behind the scenes. And I think there was a lot of political ties that were allowing things to kind of continue. Continuing on in the 1950s, there was, the Santa Anita track wasn't making as much money as it had been in previous years. And so there was a push to try to restructure some of the board and some of the inspectors, and it was suggested that they use women to be inspectors. And the chairman, Dwight Murphy, said that without the inspectors, the board would only have 3 girl clerks whom he couldn't send to the stables or have them catch crooks or touts. And I just want this man to know that someday women do become cops. So I just thought it was really funny that women were not allowed to go into the barn in the 1950s because they were, like, too feeble.
Weird.
But by the end of the 1950s, the track just kind of lost a lot of its glamour that it had in the previous decades. It wasn't this glamorous spectator sport that a lot of people had once loved about horse racing. Like, things were just changing. And at the same time, horses and people were being injured, but they just weren't, it just wasn't being reported. I did find some mention of a horse that snapped its leg while running, another one that snapped its leg after a collision, and I did keep looking for drugs and information about drugs, but I never really found it. There wasn't a lot of investigations that were reported and things like that. But by the 1960s, by the end of the 1960s, the track made about $18 million in earnings, which was down. This was a loss to the track because it was becoming more and more expensive to operate the track.
Ah, inflation.
Yes. Inflation. The 1970s got off to a slow start as the winter racing season was delayed by another strike, the building service employee strike. They wanted a they wanted more money, obviously, but this strike cost the state approximately $300,000 a day in taxes.
Wow, that's a lot.
That's 1969, 1970, they're making $300,000 a day that this track is operating. And California has tracks, lots of tracks operating. It's not just Santa Anita.
See, that's crazy how intertwined the city is with the, like, continuation of gambling and the racing.
Yep. By the 1970s, like the end of the 1970s, the track was becoming more and more desperate in order to make money, and they started selling off parts of the track, or not selling off, but developing parts of the track as malls. So there is the Santa Anita Westfield Mall is built around the track. There's also Fashion Park. So there's a lot of shopping centers right on the track that were a way to try to make more income for the track itself, as they did own that property.
That's crazy. That's got to be so weird, though, to, like, be at a racetrack and, like, you look one way and there's horses, and you look the other way and there's, like, a Macy's.
Yeah, like, they tore down barns and stuff and old practice tracks to convert it to a Macy's. So by the end of the 70s, the track was annually bringing in close to $200,000 in taxes alone just for this city. And that's about $1.5 million of today's money. So the city was making about $1.5 million a year.
Damn, that's not bad.
It's not bad at all. And again, that's, no one wants to lose that money. So by 1980, big things were on the horizon for Santa Anita, specifically the Summer Olympics. So LA won the bid to host the Olympics in 1984. And by won, I mean they were the only ones that wanted it, as previous Olympics had some terrorism issues and there was a big economic collapse during the 1976 Olympics. So, like, no one really wanted to host it. Only LA wanted to host it. And so Santa Anita ended up playing the host, like, that's where the equestrian Olympics were held, was at Santa Anita. I also want to point out that by the 1980s, they no longer had to worry about some of their fears from the 1930s Olympics. So the 1930s Olympics, I found articles where they were really concerned. It was a concern of theirs, Olympic Committee, about peat bog fires. So apparently in the 1930s, there used to be a lot of peat bogs around LA that would randomly catch on fire, and there was no way to put them out. And this included a location on the Baldwin Ranch on the Santa Anita Park property, where a young girl was running and fell into a burning peat bog. She survived.
Oh my God.
But then the city had to spend 6 months trying to put the fire out because there was no way to put the fire out because it's burning underground. So they went out there with, like, a bunch of hoses, and every time they would, like, stick a hose in and turn it on into this bog, water and, like, gas would just shoot up out, like, another side.
Oh my God.
6 months of them just, like, sticking hoses and water shooting up. But that was the 30s. Times were different in the 30s. You had a lot more to worry about. So I don't understand the FEI. This is something I'm going to have to look into. But why is the president of the FEI always royalty?
Who's the current president of the FEI?
She's a princess from a country.
It is royalty?
It is royalty. Yeah, at this time in the 80s, it was Prince Philip. Prince Philip was the current head of the FEI, so he ended up, like, coming out to Santa Anita, meeting with the Olympic Committee and looking over the property. He actually, I didn't realize this, but he is a helicopter pilot in the Royal Air Force, and so he was really excited because he got to fly the helicopter out from, like, to Santa Anita and, like, back where the Queen was doing other stuff because the Queen was in California as well. But the LA Games did mark a change. It was, like, the first commercial Olympics where there was a lot of corporate sponsors. And this is now the format that goes forward for all Olympics, because the 1984 Olympics brought in $223 million in revenue for the Games, which is huge. This also, the U.S. did really well in this Olympics. They got gold medals in quite a few events, including show jumping, which we've previously discussed in George Morris's episode about how well they did in the 1984 Olympics because they didn't cheat at all. I'm just kidding.
They cheated just a little bit, okay?
Just a little bit.
Just a tiny bit.
So a strange event actually occurred at the Olympics or around the Olympics. So in August 2nd, 1984, Olympic athletes from France, Japan, and Italy were being transported from the track back to the Olympic Village, which was on one of the neighboring universities. So they were being transported in a bus, and I'm pretty sure they were riders. That's what the, like, articles allude to, that they were equestrian athletes, but it didn't, like, clarify that for sure. But anyways, they had a security guard on the bus who's, like, watching around, and he notices that there's a car following them and driving super erratically. And so he calls the police, and the police pull over this car, and they search the car and find it full of, like, hand grenades and ninja stars. Because this man who was following them believed he was a street warrior and he was there to protect the athletes. So, and he said, he's like, guys, I don't know why you're upset. I've been following buses around all week. It's not a problem.
What a combination, though. Hand grenades and ninja stars.
Yeah. Well, I guess I think they're called throwing stars, but apparently those are illegal. I didn't know throwing stars were illegal.
Yeah, no, they are. They're definitely frowned upon. But what? Okay, here's a question. What do you throw first? Do you throw the grenade first and then just like finish off them with ninja stars? Or do you do the stars first, then the grenade?
I think you just get one in each hand and you just like grenade, ninja star, boom, 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 you know? And it's like.
You do an alternating pattern.
I think so. I think you just woo woo. But yeah, he was just like following around the buses when the athletes went from the gate, like the parks to the village and back and forth. So the FEI, their webpage says the only major complaint about this games was that there wasn't enough access to the riders for interviews and that they didn't have enough like fax machines to send articles. Didn't mention anything about athletes being stalked by grenades and ninja stars. Well, I have a different idea of what the biggest issue was, FEI, but thanks. Fax machines. It was lack of fax machines. The following summer, after the Olympic Games, everything was back to normal. They were dealing with nearly $20 million a day in wagers, and the state was collecting about $140 million a year in horse racing licenses alone. So just to have horses registered to run in the state of California was making California $140 million a year. Not even their cut of the wagers and taxes.
Jeez, when you get that much money going into something, no wonder Santa Anita looks the way it does.
Yeah. Hosting the Olympics was like the jewel in Santa Anita's cap for that decade because 1989 sort of closes out with the first drug scandal. So this was poorly reported. Like this is like one of something I'm going to like, there's a couple things that happened in the 80s and 90s where it's like, I'd really like a follow-up piece. Why is there not a part two to this? Like another article.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
In the winter of 1989, the California Race Board came under heavy criticism for not keeping a closer eye on the equine athletes and their trainers who were apparently injecting the horses with cocaine. I know it was the 80s, but like...
The cocaine has made its return.
Yeah, so the horses, so I found out this is the horses that were getting a cocaine, Santa Anita. So it was first reported like back in 1988, but... The California Race Board wasn't doing anything about it. And what was, I don't know exactly who it was, but if there was vets or if it was just horse-loving people that were involved in the track, knew something was going on. They knew horses were getting cocaine, yet no horse was testing positive. And so what they started doing is they started taking the urine samples that were being sent to the lab. So the state lab that they'd been using in California they'd been using that lab for 40 years. And so that lab had great incentive to work with the board and to keep maybe things from coming up in tests. So what they started doing was sending these samples to a lab in New Mexico. And the New Mexico lab was like, yeah, they all have cocaine in them. I don't know why the California lab is saying they don't, because they all have cocaine. And so Roger Stein was one of the few people who was actually punished for this. So he ended up being suspended for 6 months after it was found that his horse had a large amount of cocaine in his system. He had to pay a $2,000 fine. And during that 6 months ban, at that time, it was a nationwide ban, and so he couldn't race at any track, let alone Santa Anita, which is something we run into today, is that those tracks don't ban state to state. It's just you're banned from that track. So this was, I don't know, like, what was going on, but basically the rumors that the lab was faking results, whole Annie Dukin moment, was true because they started testing old samples and were like, yeah, look at that. There is cocaine in them. And so Roger Stein and like one other guy were punished. And Roger was really upset because he's like, this feels like a personal vendetta against me. Like, I don't know how my horse got cocaine in its system, which is what they all say.
Yeah, I don't know how this cocaine got in my pants.
It's not my pants. It's my buddy's pants. And it must be my buddy's cocaine. It's my buddy. Like, exactly. But it kind of was a personal vendetta because he was one of the few people that took the fall for it when it was a much wider issue than just him.
Yeah, weird.
And it was actually really frustrating because they really didn't do many news articles into this. But the following year, I think like 1989, in February, they published this stupid piece mocking, like every newspaper runs this piece that is mocking the police, the whole scandal. And it's a comedy piece where they're interviewing the horses and like, why are you on drugs? But like, that's how it closes. There's no like follow-up piece. There's no discussion about the drugs, the greater impact, et cetera, et cetera. They just run this comedy piece basically mocking the whole thing and like what it'd be like to interview a horse about drugs.
What?
Yeah. It's stupid. And I
have so many questions.
I have so many questions too. I want to know more. And what I found interesting is that there were previous articles I had come across where stable boys were getting arrested for being cocaine dealers at the track. And it was presumed they were cocaine was for them, but now I'm wondering, was the cocaine actually for the stable boys or was it for their horses?
No, 100% that was for the horses.
Right, but no one did any further investigation. They just were like, that's embarrassing.
Ah, that's crazy. Also, who's gonna give a horse coke? I Trin's crazy enough on her own. I don't need her coked up.
I mean, and cocaine, that's the good stuff too, you know? Like,
I know, who has money for that? Jeez.
Rich people. The 1990s also started with some weird things happening. So November 1990, two men ended up in dispute while the track is fully occupied. 30,000 people. They get upset with each other near the training paddocks, and one dude shoots the other multiple times.
Ow.
Yeah, kills him, murders him in front of 30,000 people. Spectators did jump on him and pin the attacker down, but like no clue what happens next. He was arrested, but like, not a follow-up piece to be found. Also, 1991, a small plane crash. That's in Anita. A single-engine plane crashes in the parking lot, doing, you know, an emergency landing, much like an emergency dismount on a horse.
Sounds like an unsuccessful landing.
Yeah, unsuccessful. Very unsuccessful. Well, when you're at that point in an airplane, it's like an unplanned dismount, you know, with a horse. You're not crashing. So another crazy event, June 1991, was the Sierra Madre earthquake. It was a 5.6 magnitude earthquake that struck California. It ended up causing between $30 and $40 million in property damage. It injured 100 people and killed 2 people. One of those people was an elderly lady who died of a heart attack. That's very sad. The other was a woman at the track watching the horses exercise when she was hit by a falling steel beam and killed.
I'm so sorry. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Holy crap. Okay, so going to the Santa Anita racetrack is like looking both ways before you cross the street, getting hit by a horse, a plane, and a steel beam.
It's dangerous. It's dangerous down there. So some weird things happened in the early 90s. However, by 1995, they had a very wet start to the season, and conditions were actually becoming dangerous. Even trainer Bobby Frankel, yes, Bethany Frankel's dad, spoke out about how dangerous it was to like race horses at the Santa Anita racetrack in 1995. Conditions in the 90s were becoming more and more dangerous just day to day. Gary Stevens even was a jockey who fell in while riding at Santa Anita, and he said that like in his post interview that it's the worst track in the United States right now. Like, I don't think it's a safe track. And this was in the 90s when they were starting to have some financial issues, because not only did a lot of bizarre things happen in the 90s, but ownership changed in the 90s.
Yes, it did.
To recap ownership up until the 90s, so from 1932 to 1934, the track was initially created, and that was Anita Baldwin owned the track, and then she leased it to the Jockey Club. She and Smoot had a falling out, and then the following year, I believe 1934, this track was actually sold, and Anita was no longer in ownership. So there were some quick changes of ownership, but essentially what happened in the up until, I think, 1965, the track was owned by the Turf Club, and whoever was the president owned the club. So it was very much a single focus, single-minded business model. The first president when the track was racing was Hal Roach, because Hal Roach and Charles Strub get a lot of credit. Like, history books kind of cut out Anita Baldwin from actually being the owner that started this track, and they give all the credit to Hal Roach or Charles Strub, even though they didn't create the track. They may have been early investors, but they didn't create the track. It wasn't their idea. The track was already under construction when they got involved. So shortly after that, I think 1936 or so, Charles Strub became the president and the owner. So Charles Strub was a dentist, a local dentist, and he played many different roles. He was the general manager. He was the vice president. He was the owner. He was the president. And depending which article you read, his title is very different. But he owned it until the late 50s when, like, his health started to fail him in the 50s and he ended up giving it over to his son. He also was investigated multiple times for illegal political campaign donations. He did definitely give his money to whoever politician he thought would be most favorable to the Santa Anita racetrack. And so that was, like, a huge issue in the, like, 40s and 50s, like, where the money was going. But his business model was really successful. So their business model was to make racing profitable by giving large prize money. So they wanted the best, they wanted Santa Anita to be the best track in the country. And they wanted to get the best horses, the best trainers, the best jockeys. And the way they wanted to do that was by giving big prize money. Honestly, that's the safest way to do it, as we find out. Giving big prize money to get the best, to work hard, and, like, yes, cheating's gonna happen, but you aren't doing it, you're doing it through quality versus quantity.
Yeah, but that business model definitely changed when new ownership came
about. Absolutely, because it's not as profitable, because you have to have the profits to give away, right? You have to be able to give away large chunks of money, and people didn't want to do that. So in 1965, the Los Angeles Turf Club, they changed their business model. So essentially what they did was they became they developed a parent company, Santa Anita Consolidated Inc. And this was going to own and operate the club, and then the jockey club or the turf club would run it. Why they did this was they wanted to go public and they wanted to sell shares of the business. And so they wanted that public investment. And so they created a new business. How they were doing it was they were pooling all the money into one pot, essentially. So everybody was sort of subsidizing everybody. So all these businesses were operated under the same business. If one lost money, it was fine because these other businesses were still successful. And that's what happened in 76 when the housing market crashed and there was an economic downturn. They actually ended up losing a lot of money because their building company lost money. But as a whole, Santa Anita lost money because they were part of that. In 1980, they decided to restructure. So in 1980, there was a tax law change that allowed them to basically create two companies, but exchange them under one. So, right, they're still a publicly owned company. You can still buy shares in them, but they're going to be under Santa Anita Operating Co. would run the track and its operations, and then Santa Anita Realty Enterprises would own sort of the land. And this was like a kind of a tax loophole, because what it allowed them to do was get out of some corporate taxes, and it allowed them to split those assets up. They quickly do this restructuring format. They split it into two companies still being sold under one, but by 1984, the tax law is rewritten and this becomes illegal or prohibited. But what it did was make them very valuable, because now there's only four or five companies in the United States that have this structure due to that tax law change. And that's how they continue to operate up until 1997, when they're losing money. Santa Anita Racetrack needs money in 1997. And because they have this unique structure, you have companies that are basically trying to get into a bidding war to buy the track because of its tax operations, because not because they're into horse racing or want to be part of that, but because they want their company structure. I found an LA Times article that is from April 1997. Santa Anita met a trust in a $383 million merger deal. So this company, MetaTrust, was a medical company. They owned, like, hospitals and things. The MetaTrust chairman, Abraham Gossman, said his firm is committed to keeping Santa Anita in horse racing. But he said the appeal of the merger for his firm lies in Santa Anita's company structure, which provides major tax advantages, not its operations, which lost $7 million in the last quarter of 1996. So again, due to this lucrative deal, they decide to buy it, and they buy the track for $175 million. The problem is MetaTrust basically over-leveraged themselves in 1997, and they ended up spending like $500 million buying different companies, buying golf courses, buying hotels. They actually bought La Quinta Inns at that time. And so they overvalued a lot of their companies. They overpurchased, and by 1998, their credit rating is junk. They are not to be like the investing newspapers and TV shows are saying, do not buy MetaTrust. They're over leveraged. They're not worth it. And so they decide in 1998, they have to unload everything. As soon as this becomes known that they are going to sell off the racetrack, there is a company, an auto parts company in Canada that becomes very interested in purchasing them, or their owner becomes very interested in purchasing them. However, their board of this Canadian auto parts group, Magna Car Parts, did not want this. The board is like, no way, we're very successful as an auto parts group. Do not get us involved in horse racing. You're going to divert funds. You're going to divert profits. So they decide to create a second company that's going to manage the racetrack. And so a year later, they buy the track for $126 million. Basically, MetaTrust took an $83 million loss on the deal because they had also, in that 1 year, invested millions of dollars in improvements into Santa Anita. So not only did they buy it for $175 million, they then invested like another $20 million in improvements to the track. So 1998, Frank Stronach. Frank Stronach to purchase a Santa Anita. Okay, so that brings us to December 1998 when Frank Stronach.
Yep.
Purchases the Santa Anita racetrack. And that is the moment that led us to 2019. So that is where I am going to leave my part because it's all their fault. That's all I'm going to say. It's all their fault. It's all the new ownership's fault that we have the mess we have at Santa Anita now.
No, it really is. I know it might seem drastic to be like, well, how can you say that? It's all these different factors. You know, it's poor footing. It's young horses being run. It's blah, blah, blah. It's not. It's they are causing all those different factors that are leading to these deaths. It is 110% on the owners who own the place and what they are pushing and what their goals are. But unfortunately, that's not what we're talking about. This episode, you're going to have to listen to part two to hear all about the new ownership and all the horse deaths that have come along with it.
Yeah. I mean, because here's the thing. When there is money to be made, a buck or two to be made, people will find a way to lie, cheat, steal, scam, and even kill to get that extra dollar. Like, it's insane.
No, it's true. It really is. And I know it might seem somewhat pointless because, I mean, everyone's here for the, you know, listening to this type of episode for the drama. They want to hear about, like, all the horse deaths and everything that, you know, all of that horrible, tragic history that Santa Anita has. But there is so much more. Like, the history that is behind Santa Anita Track, I mean, the fact that it was used in an internment camp, that is insane and just speaks to literally the bloody history that is this track and that it has never been a clean, safe, or savory place.
Well, I think it's also important to understand first what was being reported so you can understand. Like, I went through the newspapers. I spent so much time on newspapers.com in those archives looking through what was available. These were not things that were being reported. They were happening. I found references to horses breaking down, but not numbers, not the articles, not the stories of it, because people didn't care. It wasn't on TV. The public wasn't bothered to see it. It didn't make news. They weren't into a follow-up story. So, like, it just wasn't there. So by the time we find out about it in 2019 and it's being publicized the way it is, that absolutely is shocking because we didn't know it was happening this whole time or didn't realize the extent to which it was happening this whole time. That is the story of Santa Anita up until the 2000s and kind of what had happened and what was publicly known about the track. Like, that's the other thing. Like, I'm reporting on what you can publicly find. Is there people with special sources? Yes, there are. I found articles to people who were tracking the deaths of horses. And even in the bad years, they were saying it's no worse than the good years. The information is there. It's just not available. Like, the board, the California board, racing board, I'm sure has all the information from, like, the 30s about how bad the track was year to year, that kind of stuff. But it's just not publicly available.
Exactly. Well, thank you guys so much for listening. We will be picking this episode up, part two, right where we left off here in the 2000s, talking about the Stronach Group acquiring the Santa Anita track. And I will be talking all about the sordid history that literally is the last just 22 years of it, which includes quite a bit. So thank you so much for listening. I hope you guys enjoyed it.
Stay safe.
Stay classy and stay in the saddle.
And write a damn follow-up piece. Don't gamble. Write a damn follow-up piece. If you murder somebody, if someone gets murdered, we need to know what happens next. Why did he murder that guy? Did that guy go to jail? Did that guy get punished? Was it first degree, second degree? I have to know these things. Write the whole story, okay?